of sentiment. He was an unbridled sentimentalist, and also was subject to visions, mysterious inner experiences, dreams, and archetypal visions and strange phenomena of sleep and waking. On one occasion in his life, he was walking along the roadside and saw a beautiful rose growing. This was while he was in exile. He went over and looked at the rose and burst into tears and fell at the base of the rose bush. He was completely overcome by the beauty of the flower. Something tremendously sentimental within himself had developed over the years and was very definitely involved in his book on the new life. But what he was trying to tell us, I think, in the book primarily, is that there is a new life. That there is an old way of going along, being selfish, being self-centered, getting all you can and giving as little as possible, and then drifting into the unknown eternity that lies ahead. This was the old way of life. And for many people, it is still the way of life, and will be for a long time to come. But these people have no dedication. And to Dante, dedication, even if it was tearful, was far more important than indifference to values. The individual who suffered for his convictions was really a happier person than an individual who rejoiced in his delinquencies. The living of a principle makes all things right. In this principle, there may be tears. There may be hours of sorrow. There may be losses. Life will not run along perfectly smooth for a person who feels deeply or who takes a very sincere and dedicated interest in life. The more serious we become, the more we can be hurt. The more dedicated we become, the more we can suffer from the insults and thoughtlessness and cruelty of other people. We are very, very sensitive. But the sensitivity which permits us to suffer is also the sensitivity that brings with it the internal enlightenment. Unless the person is sensitive, the overtones do not come through. But the person who is sensitive and is able to register the overtones is also hurt by the profaneness of mortal existence. So this is part of a mystical type of life. It has been true of mystics since the beginning, that they have paid for their insight by having an understanding or realization of values that brings with it a certain amount of pain, a certain amount of disappointment, and in many instances, many flowings of tears and grief. But it is all worthwhile, because without this, there is no way of bringing about the regaining of paradise. In the Divine Comedy, Beatrice, who is a symbol of the soul, the eternal feminine, and an embodiment of the Virgin Mary, Beatrice becomes his guide in Paradiso. After he has wandered through the underworld with Virgil, he comes finally to the better world, and here he is led by Beatrice through the various regions that lead ultimately to the supreme heavenly abode. Therefore, as the soul, of course, Beatrice becomes the leader of the redeemed, becomes this power which leads the individual in the afterlife because he has attained the power of it in the present life. If he lives in this world according to the power of his own soul, he can face the future without fear, for the soul he has fashioned here will serve him hereafter. The soul, then, is the primary factor in the situation, and of course is also the primary objective of the alchemists, was the creation and integration of the power of the soul as the universal medicine for the corruptions of the flesh. The Greeks had their own understanding of soul. Modern psychologists have theirs also. But I think the real answer lies in the fact that the soul is something that is not fashioned primarily at a particular moment in life. I rather like to feel with certain of the classical thinkers that the soul is that part of us which really carries the record from one embodiment to another and so on. All embodiments in the flesh are actually necessary to the gradual unfoldment of the soul power. Therefore, in the presence of any emergency in this world, the soul carries the record of the most that we have ever learned in the great cycle of embodiments. All the learning of our past lives, all the wisdom we have gained, all the mellowing and fulfilling we have known, and all through our growth in nature, is finally epitomized and summarized in the present state of the human soul. Therefore, the soul is wiser than the mind, the soul is far older than the body, and the soul alone provides us with this mysterious power of conscience, by means of which we remember dimly what is wrong, although we may not have any detail. The soul convicts us when we betray it, or betray any other part of our natures, or any condition of life, or go contrary to the common good. Now, out of all of this, we come to another problem, and that is the city. There is a mysterious city, the great castle of the troubadours. There is the mysterious city, the utopias of classical and later learning. There is this mysterious better world that is supposed to lie beyond our mortal ken. Actually, the city of the troubadour, the castle of the Virgin of the world, is this world that we live in now, which we must gradually transmute until the leadership and rulership of the world is transferred from the political and social problems that we know now to a reformed, regenerated, and redeemed social structure. In other words, soul must come of age not only in the individual but in his civilization. A soulless empire is as sick as a soulless person, and a world which has neglected soul will always be subject to disaster. That which has not corrected its own mistakes will perpetuate them, and wherever the immature become leaders of society, the social structure is endangered. So the perfect world that we would like to think of, the earthly paradise that is promised in the sacred and ancient writings, actually is a redeemed world, a world that has come down to us, and the New Jerusalem, which in sense is termed the Bride of the Lamb. The church was the bride of Christ. The soul, in a sense, is the actual bride of Christ. The city that has become ruled by the light of truth is therefore adorned as a bride. And in the city that is ruled by soul power, the divine power itself incarnates or becomes embodied, in involving concepts of the return or the recoming of a great Messiah or a great Messianic Savior. All these things are part of the victory of soul power over brute power, as that Mahatma Gandhi called it. And there never will be a solution to problem until this power of the inner good is given leadership over life. When man was fashioned, the soul potential as a seed, according to Bainley, was planted in his heart. These are also the Buddha seeds referred to in Buddhism. The soul is a seed originally, but if it is nursed and cared for, it grows into a beautiful plant, and this plant in turn becomes a great tree, and this tree bears many manner of fruit, and the fruit is for the healing of the nations. The soul tree, therefore, with its roots in the heart, becomes the shade under which we can all rest in peace, or the palm in the desert, in the oasis. And the soul is the private, personal oasis. And in the world, the soul is a civilization or culture that is founded upon the integrities of life. Now, we've never had a complete world that was founded upon such integrities. Many different nations have tried. Many peoples have attempted the effort. But in almost every instance, they have drifted away from the original purpose. This country was founded by persons deeply involved in the attainment of a nation with power of soul, a world, a way of life, which was according to what the God of nature willed it to be. Gradually, however, the selfishness has cut out the power of the true directives upon which a nation must survive. Just as selfishness afflicts us as individuals, self-centeredness has afflicted the world politically, economically, and industrially. Therefore, the great dream of a better way of life has gradually become obscured. And as this becomes obscured, the result is devastating in terms of the survival of a civilization. Now, in the case of a person who has a conscience, a soul within himself, and has, as a human being, the potential power of doing that which is right, a power to discern the difference between right and wrong, then the capacity to choose to be right. When this person fails to make this type of choice and drifts along with one compromise after another, we find little by little that the body, which is the physical institution in which the soul dwells, becomes corrupted. By degrees, the mistakes of the mind and the emotions begin to bear down upon the body. Little by little, they sicken it, corrupt it, disease it, until finally the body dies of the intemperances of that which dominates it, or leads it, or is involved within it. And where the mind or the uncultured emotions become intemperances, the body perishes. The same is true of a society. No nation that departs from the laws of integrity that allows the soul power to weaken can ever hope to be a success. Now, what are the soul power virtues in a person or in a collective? The soul power virtues in a person are represented by a kind of self-discipline in which the individual restrains and restricts destructive attitudes, in which he determines to do that which is closest to the common good. And the principal textbook for Western man on how this is to be accomplished is the Holy Bible. Here the individual learns what is expected of a person who claims to be truly religious. And these simple rules and attitudes and convictions become the basis of a morality for millions and hundreds of millions of human beings. It follows, however, that if these are ignored, if the religions that teach them are downgraded, if we are gradually taught to be ignorant, which is a trick if you can do it, and it's being done, we are being taught to be ignorant. We are being inspired to be stupid and believe that that is the answer to all the things we want. While this condition remains, we will never be able to take the leadership away from our appetites and reaffirm these values in terms of aspiration. So the thing is, a culture becomes worse and worse. Our own relationships with life weaken. How are we going to help to restore this balance of power so that we can do something right? History tells us that usually the only way we can achieve this end is through disaster. Something must happen by means of which we suddenly, dramatically realize that we have been terribly wrong. Something must happen so that our mistakes are too painful to continue. We must reach a point where we can't live with ourselves the way we are. As long as we can be reasonably comfortable and keep our faults, we will. But when our faults hurt so badly we cannot endure them, then we do something about them. It's the same way as a sick person who has aches and pains and neglects them, who is warned that care is necessary, pays no attention to it. When, however, a major ailment sets in, then the individual begins to listen and decides to do what he can to correct the situation if it's not too late. The same is true in society. Also, not only must we do these changes or make these changes in our own living, but we must gradually support these changes in collective society. We must try to move our way of life from a purely mental focus to a heart understanding. In Asia, the Buddhist philosophy is called the heart doctrine. And the heart doctrine in the East has always been recognized as paramount. It has always been accepted that all mind and all mentation has as its primary purpose to find ways to fulfill the ideals of the heart. The heart is the true leader, not the mind. But where the heart is perverted or left unenlightened, it can be troublesome also. But an undeveloped heart in an undeveloped mind is an impossible combination and is bound to produce trouble. So in Dante's understanding of this mysticism, the secret allegiance of the human being to the way of his own heart, an allegiance he tells to no one. He tells no one who his true love is. He would never in any way desecrate the object of his affection by associating himself with it. He knows that he is imperfect, and he is not going to damage the reputation of truth by claiming to possess it and then not live it. So in silence, in complete absence of personal acclaim or recognition, he quietly venerates truth, lives with it, assumes it to be the great love of his life, cherishes it, protects it, but is silent, only showing it by his attitude in various respects, but never proclaiming his true devotion. He doesn't tell other people that he is in love with truth, because if he does and makes a few bad mistakes, people will say truth is wrong. He is not going to disfigure the reality by claiming to possess it, but he is going to glorify it by continuing to serve it day and night, life after life, until through complete submission to the divine plan and the divine purpose, by accepting humbly the wisdom of God and the love of God, he is prepared for the next step in the great development of human life and human purpose. So Dante takes this attitude very, very clearly. He is also involved with another interesting factor, and that is that Amor, or Cupid, as it was known in the Greek mythology, who is more or less the deity presiding over love, is male, not female. But Cupid is God as love. In other words, Cupid becomes the divine attribute of love, God, the attribute of love as it is in the divine nature, pure, uncontaminated, and undefiled. It is the divine power as love. And as love, it is the source of all the messianic saviors. Love as the redeeming power within the nature of deity itself. Therefore, in a sense, love is the second aspect of deity. It is also the only begotten of the Father. Love, therefore, enters into the life of Dante as a mysterious being. And this mysterious being is the one that guides him and guards him in his relationships with Beatrice. Beatrice becomes, therefore, the symbol or the embodiment of the vision that true love, as the God power, has bestowed upon Dante. In other words, love in its perfect nature has made it possible for him to love something. And this love of something or someone is made possible because God is love. And therefore, it is not an accidental thing. Love is not dependent upon the human being for its survival. It is part of the divine nature. Worlds come and go. Continents rise and fall. Even space itself is constantly changing its complexion. But the supreme power governing all things governs with love and wisdom. And this love is the eternal rightness of things, which Dante gradually comes to understand. And it is this love which is God, which he is able to manifest through himself in his love for Beatrice. Beatrice, therefore, signifies the proper object of divine love. It represents the symbol of the purpose of love. The purpose of love is to bestow. Love is not something that locks itself within itself and stays there. It must manifest, and the divine love, which is placed in the human heart, manifests through love of something. Love of peace, love of good, love of virtue, love of friend, love of family. The love principle becomes the basis of the growth of the soul power in the person. Therefore, this character appears and floats through Dante's book, always bearing witness to the fact that it is because love exists that the human being can love. That it is because love is one of the strongest laws in the universe that it becomes the criterion of all accomplishment. If it was not that love is eternal, all things of themselves would be exhausted in their efforts to develop integrities and values. Love is not mental, primarily, nor is it amental. It is not against the mind, but love expresses through the regenerated mind. It recognizes the regenerated emotions, and in a strange way, in nature itself, in natural processes, the eternal love operates in the maintenance of the human body also. Love is the thing by means of which all motivation is brought about, motivation to return to God. And that which is against this motivation is against God. Now, man, being a frail creature and imperfect in all his parts, is unable sometimes to handle the mystery of love. It becomes too complicated for him. He mixes up with passion or lust or greed. He loves worldliness, which in itself is an anachronism. But he has within himself the capacity for the true ideal affection, which is represented in Dante's book. Dante experienced it in himself as a mystical experience. He found it not in the world, but in himself. It was in his dreams that the perfect devotion was revealed. It was in dreams beyond this world that which must come to this world first appeared. Therefore, in Dante's idea, or ideal, the eternal beauty, which we must ultimately cultivate, is first available only as a mystical experience within ourselves. The beginning of true love is a mystical experience within the person. It is something which can be experienced only in vision, in some strange emergency, in a great tragedy or disaster in which the person has to retire into himself to gain the strength of survival. Therefore, the true affection is a kind of archetypal thing found first in dreams. But from the dream, it is gradually transmitted into a more tangible form. But this mysterious love is forever limited or localized to an inward experience. It is something that happens inside. It cannot be clearly communicated in words. It cannot be demonstrated alone by action. Though to understand it or to accept it, you must meet it on its own level. And this the average person cannot do. The person may be grateful for the kindness of another, but this gratitude may not in any sense touch the core of himself, in which he would find the kinship of two true minds or true hearts. So to us, the things we try to do nicely are simply episodes. They're incidents. They're natural tendencies. It is natural for parents to love their children. It is natural for us to be kind to our friends. But it is also, unfortunately, too natural to us to be unkind to our enemies. And in this state of affairs, we prove that we do not understand the deeper meaning of the ideals of that we even find in the Sermon on the Mount. Do good to those that despitefully use you. This is a statement from the soul, but very few people are willing to justify it by backing it up mentally or physically. It remains a beautiful abstraction. We have not recognized it yet as an absolute necessity. Out of the whole concept, then, there is a maturing of life. And this maturing of life is gradually a transformation by which we ascend from our present objective focus to a way of leadership in which we become the servants of the divine love of God, in which everything that comes through us is already completely transformed, so that every action is an extension of the divine power through our own lives. It is gradually becoming possible for us to be led by the soul in the ways of righteousness. It is possible for us to shift from the selfishness that we now nourish to the divine plan for which we were intended. And the key to this is our power to express devotion, dedication. And the emotion that leads to this, the only acceptable emotion in nature, is the emotion of the love of man for the divine. And that this love for the divine, by natural extension, extends into all things that are fashioned by the divine. Therefore, to love God is to love all creation and all creatures, including the enemies. It is part of our possibility, then, to build a world around conscience, around soul extension and soul power, a world that shall sometime find the answers which it is seeking today. We are gravely worried at the moment because of the dangers of a nuclear holocaust or a danger of the pollution of our world. All such infirmities and miseries have their origin in human selfishness. These are not the manifestations of the love of one human being for another, or the love of any human being for God. These are manifestations of self-interest. They are the power that has resulted, as we learn in St. Augustine, in transforming the city of God into the city of death. We have transformed heaven into a Babylon. And that which was intended to be a beautiful place where we could grow together in righteousness has been corrupted by our own selfishness. And selfishness is both mental and emotional. Mental is the incentive. Mental is the justification. Mental is the conspiracy of working out how to attain these ends. But emotion is also the appetites by means of which we justify the conspiracies of the mind. We say to ourselves, I want this. This is emotional. Therefore, we say, in this way, I can get it. And that is mental. And in this problem of decision, we are very seldom strictly ethical. We make compromises of all kinds to justify our own purposes. So we have to overcome this in one way or another. Either have change forced upon us or make the change by the strength of character within ourselves. Dante's idea is very simple on this matter. Truth is something very beautiful. It's the most beautiful thing imaginable. Just exactly what it is and how to define it is not really very easy to say. But Dante defines it as the absolute object of all human search. He defines it, therefore, in the most perfect form that he can imagine it, and that is the form of the Virgin Mary, the Virgin of the world, the perfect virtue, the perfect good, the eternal mother, that which is forever provident, that which is forever meditating upon the well-being of its offspring everywhere, the protectress, the enlightener, the leader of the whole program of redemption, in which it is the love of the great mother that would make the world safe for all her children. So Dante takes this symbol under the name of Beatrice, which was not, incidentally, the actual name of the young lady who was supposed to be involved. But Beatrice was good because it goes with beatitude and all the terms that have to do with grace. But in this case, he has created an image like a very wonderful mandala, a sacred symbol to represent the eternal mother of life as manifested through this beautiful person in whom all the virtues of life he feels are personified. Therefore, he adores this. He worships it. He grieves over it. He grieves after having it being deprived of it. But finally, when Beatrice in his vision, the perfect symbol in his vision, dies, he is not as disconsolate as might be seen, because she is the soul. And if the soul dies, he feels that when the time comes, he will go forth and join her. And that together, as in the Divine Comedy, they will advance to paradise or to the heavenly regions, because she, as love, will lead him there. He cannot go alone. This type of symbolism has so many amplifications and so many ramifications, weeks, months can be spent in trying to interpret all of its mystery. But it tells us, as for another thing, for example, that Dante realizes that within his own masculine body is a feminine soul, that he is in a strange way an androgyne already, that the woman in him is there, and that represents the best part of himself, and that therefore in obeying the feminine or anima of his own nature, he is fulfilling the divine plan, because it is this which will lead him. All that is worthwhile will come from his own soul, from that which is the inner part of his own life. And if he is led by the inner part, he will go in glory. If he is led by the outer part, he will suffer through ages of vicissitudes. So all of these elements have their own little sense and line, and occasionally, and quite regularly, in fact, in the Vita Nuova, he writes a little sonnet or a little love poem to this mysterious lady. He also writes some music to her. He is forever honoring her, wishing her all joy and peace. But he never sends her the poems. No, that wouldn't be proper. He simply keeps them. He has expressed his devotion, but he never sends the letter to Beatrice. Rather, he has discovered that in the poem or in the sonnet, which he has written with his mind, he is actually paying tribute to his own soul. That the mind has written its poem, the hand has traced the letters, but the soul alone knows what it means. And that this secret meaning is life, his daily actions. He does not fully understand. He never would possibly write him and pass on the information. But the action which he makes, the dedicated effort that he is constantly engaged in, of venerating, worshiping, and respecting his own soul. The soul itself will know. It doesn't have to be told. It does not have to receive the message, because the message is written out of its own content, out of the soul's own appreciation of things. So Dante has a little private world of his own, which he lived in and in which he died. A world in which his entire life, or the most of it at least, was devoted to the strange mystical inner experiences which he passed through along the way, experiences which taught him that somewhere inside of himself was the virgin of the world, worthy of all respect, and somewhere in space was the mother of mysteries, and that this whole great pageantry of love is an eternal mother principle manifesting through a world created for the purpose of sharing in the beauties and graces of heavenly insight. That the whole world is a great family, and that the fatherhood of God and the motherhood of God are one thing. The wisdom and love rule all things, and if man will obey these principles and rescue the feelings, the emotions of them from within himself, he will be so busy worshiping the beautiful and recognizing the good that he will have little time for complaint or for any of the negative attitudes and doubts and fears. Dante had his doubts and his fears, but he took them to the eternal feminine, and she brought him peace. We take our problems to the soul within us. If it understands and we permit, it will bring us peace. And it also gradually will bring the world peace and make possible a world for those who come after us that is far better than anything we have ever known. I think it's a very interesting point of view as expressed in the story of the new life, the life of love in a world of uncertainties. Well, friends, I guess that's all for this morning.